Welcome back to Eco Talk, and we are proud to welcome the Union of Concerned Scientists to our show. Union of Concerned Scientists joining us as our latest environmental partner, and this is the Partners Corner. We usually put it in the last segment of our show, but because the topic is bigger than that, bigger than we can fit into 6 minutes, we're going to spend two segments talking with the president of the Union of Concerned Scientists. That is Kevin Knobloch. He joins us again. He was a guest once before on the show, and thank you for being with us, Kevin.
Thank you, Betsy. I'm delighted to be with you.
So global warming, wow. You know, it's scary, it's depressing, it's at times paralyzing, but we're going to take a different take on what the silver or green lining might be from having had 2005 be a year where it really seemed to become real to Americans. Is that something that you agree with?
I do. I think that there is a prairie fire of action and leadership across this country responding to global warming, but responding to it in a way that is quite positive, that's producing jobs, producing community investment, cleaning up the air, reducing our dependence on imported oil from undemocratic and unstable parts of the globe.
And one of the things we're going to be doing in this last half of the show is bringing you the voices, the sounds, the sound bites from some folks who have been on EcoTalk in 2005 talking about global warming. And one of the more inspiring developments was the great success, as you mentioned, in grassroots efforts to bring folks together and give them, us, a voice to express our concern about climate change. Lori David, the founder of the StopGlobalWarming.org virtual march, and, of course, husband of Seinfeld co-creator Larry David, is trying to get more Americans to curb their emissions by staying home.
There are so many people working on this issue. When you wanted to build a movement in the old days, you'd go out and you'd march on Washington, but they just haven't been working lately. I thought, well, let's march on the Internet, and let's do it for a year, and let's count every single person that joins the march, and let's have it be about everybody, all the environmental groups and all the religious groups, politicians, Republican and Democrat.
And if you haven't signed the Stop Global Warming petition, go to stopglobalwarming.org. And that's just one of many efforts to really get all citizens involved in this issue. One of the things I like about that particular campaign, first of all, you don't actually have to go to Washington and wear down your tennis shoes. It is all virtual. And they really take you along this virtual journey across America and help you learn about the impacts of global warming, as far as we can tell, in various locales. Kevin, what kind of campaign does Union of Concerned Scientists have? I'm assuming you have one.
Well, we're certainly supportive of Lori's virtual march, and people can go to her website, and there's a whole range of featured marchers. I'm one of them.
And so am I.
And sign on, and then send it on around to your friends. And it's really superb that way. We have what we call a climate solutions campaign, because global warming is in large part a human-caused problem, and the upside of that is that human ingenuity is key to solving it, that we have the ability to turn this around. So we, you know, at the Union of Concerned Scientists, we have our climate scientists who help us understand what's happening to the climate, to our environment, writ large. And then we look at what the impacts are in the regions around the country. And then we don't just focus on the problem. We say, look, here's the solutions: much more efficient cars, buses, and trucks, much more efficient appliances, rolling out renewable energy on a very aggressive scale, rewiring the electricity grid, which is last century's patchwork of technologies, when we have the technology to make it far more efficient and in fact reliable. We're really focused on showing that the technology exists to dramatically reduce these global warming pollutants and bring along all these other benefits with it.
And how much of a role do you think the record hurricane season played, whether it was actually a function of global warming or not? Will we ever be able to prove it? But it certainly has some people talking about it in a way that they weren't before.
I think it really has caught people's attention, Betsy. You know, that a lot of people, because they're gardeners, or they, like me, they play pond hockey in the winter, or they're hikers, or they're duck hunters, have noticed almost kind of anecdotally over the last decade or two that their local climates are changing. The ponds are freezing later and thawing earlier. The wetlands are drying up more. The sugar maples are migrating north. But they weren't, you know, we weren't quite sure what exactly was going on. We knew something was afoot. And I think when a major event like the hurricane season we just had comes along, people start to connect those dots. They say, oh, you know, something's going on. What the science shows, Betsy, is that because as ocean temperatures warm, which is one of the major things happening with global warming, that those warming temperatures give more energy to tropical storms. So that global warming can't be blamed for an increasing number of hurricanes necessarily. The scientists haven't been able to show that. They have been able to show that global warming is leading to an increased intensity of storms, damaging them.
And there are a few skeptics out there. Do you think we'll hear less from the skeptics in 2006 and more from people who are just about solutions? Let's stop debating about whether humans are actually the problem.
I do. I think we've turned that corner. The number of climate skeptics out there are shrinking rapidly. The number of climate skeptics who are credentialed scientists are extremely few, and there are many thousands of scientists who highly experienced, knowledgeable, who spend their day studying climate change, who believe that climate change is real, and we've got to act urgently.
Well, interestingly, in our last segment, you weren't able to hear that, but we spoke with a scientist at Scripps Institution in Southern California, and he was a global warming skeptic, became a believer once he started listening to fellow scientists and said, I better look at this more carefully. And in fact, the data he felt was incontrovertible, that, you know, it's here, that, of course, it is coming from our burning of fossil fuels. But he was one who does not necessarily think we can tie it to the, you know, devastating storm season we just saw. So we like to present all views, because who knows for sure? But I always say, wouldn't it be better err on the side of caution and assume that, you know, this is all connected, and we are seeing, you know, devastating droughts in the Brazilian Amazon rainforest. I mean, if you put it all together, it does seem like something is making Mother Nature angry, and hell hath no fury like Mother Nature ignored.
Well, you know, we take out insurance, like, say, fire insurance on our home for far lower probabilities. You know, you take out fire insurance on your home, you don't necessarily expect your home to burn down, but you know that if it happens, it will be catastrophic. It'll be devastating. Our federal government policy on global warming is extremely reckless, in that the president has refused to take even the most basic precautionary steps. There's a whole range of things we can and should be doing to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that will, you know, serve as that insurance, and at the same time, you know, reduce respiratory disease, decrease our dependence on imported oil, and increase our national security in that respect.
And before we get to all the solutions, which we're going to focus on in our next segment, let's just sort of continue with our walk through what has happened in 2005. And while the U.S. is slowly, too slowly in the case of our administration, waking up, the rest of the world seems to get it. And one of my favorite guests who we had on the show a couple of times in the past year is Ross Gelbspan. He is the prize-winning journalist and author of Boiling Point. And he's been writing about this for several years. And he says the rest of the world gets it. We need to catch on.
Well, the United States is going ahead with their emissions and no reductions. Holland is cutting their emissions by 80% in 40 years. Tony Blair has committed Britain to cut emissions by 60% in 50 years. The Germans have agreed to 50% cuts in 50 years. And about 4 months ago, French President Chirac called on the entire industrial world to cut emissions by 75% in the next 45 years.
So I guess the take-home message is, wake up, America, and smell the carbon dioxide.
Well, I think that's very well said. You know, I was just in Montreal in December for the International Climate Talks, and I was really struck by how increasingly isolated our president and the delegation that he sent up to there is. The developing countries like China and India were stepping up and saying, you know, we understand we need to be part of the Kyoto Protocol and start to reduce our emissions. The developed world starting to talk about the next round of deeper cuts that they need to achieve. The U.S. delegation was like a junior, you know, it was like in junior high school. They were objecting to any proposal that included the words dialogue or process. It was quite embarrassing. It would have been embarrassing if it wasn't really ultimately so irresponsible and reckless.
Yeah, arrogant and petulant come to mind. I call this fossil foolishness.
It's the Climate Action Network, which is the coalition of environmental groups up there. They had an annual fossil award, the Fossil of the Day award that they would give out, and I'm afraid the U.S. delegation won its share of those. And it's a shame because it's basically You know, what we're able to show, Betsy, up there was that the Bush administration ought not to be confused with the rest of the United States. That Greg Nickels, the mayor of Seattle, was up there. Greg, in the year 2005, organized almost 200 mayors, Republicans and Democrats, red states, blue states, across the country, who committed their municipalities to reducing global warming pollutants in line with the Kyoto Protocol. You know, 21 states, I think, across the country have adopted a renewable electricity standard, where they're rolling out much greater percentages of renewable energy. 9 states have joined California in regulating global warming pollutants from the tailpipe of cars and trucks.
So this is really the year that local and state, not only government, but, you know, citizens and mayors really, you know, got involved, seeing that the administration is not leading the way, so get out of the way.
That's right. It's I don't know if Ted Turner coined it, but, you know, I have a paperweight on my desk that's from him that says, lead, follow, or get out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really the message that the Bush administration was getting in Montreal. You know, you can't not be party to the rest of the world's efforts to reduce these emissions. You know, it's one thing to step out of it. It's quite another thing to step out of it and then insist that no one else go forward.
Especially when you're the same administration that's asking the rest of the world to go into Iraq with you and come along when you're isolating yourself on another, I would say, even more important front. Stay with us. Kevin Knobloch, president of Union of Concerned Scientists. We'll continue our conversation when we come back. Welcome back to Eco Talk, and we are in conversation with Kevin Knobloch. He runs the Union of Concerned Scientists, one of my favorite environmental groups, because they all are scientists, after all. And before we go into how we can build on the momentum of what hopefully is a tipping point in encouraging awareness and actions to combat global warming, how many scientists do you have in your organization? I've always wondered.
Well, we have about 70,000 members. We don't have an exact count of the number of scientists in that mix, but it's probably somewhere in the 40 to 50% range. We also have engineers, medical professionals, and then a lot of people who don't have those advanced degrees, who are just, you know,
concerned
citizens, but they support our mission of bringing strong science to public policy making.
So let's look at what it's going to take to really create a tipping point of public action. And we can't, of course, stop the fact that global warming is coming, or even that it's here. Denial certainly will not do us any good. We need to stop that. We've made that clear, I think. But we can't stop it from getting worse, or hopefully we can, and we must, or be prepared at least to then explain to our kids that we ignored so many red flags and left them a compromised environment that affects so many things, from economy to health to basic survival. Steve Cochran is Director of Strategic Communications for Environmental Defense Fund. He says that simply rolling over and adapting to what's to come is just not good enough.
We are going to have a combination of adaptation, as 3D people call it, and the question is how much are we going to have to adapt. You know, we just have been through a difficult period down on the Gulf Coast. That the storms, in fact, get worse because the water is warmer does seem to be increasingly clear. And so for people who have argued, as the administration and others have, that, well, we just need a good, strong program for adaptation. Well, adaptation means dealing with that kind of intensity in those kinds of storms, and I don't think anybody any longer thinks that that's a rational approach.
I'm sure you agree with that view.
I do. Because greenhouse gas emissions stay up in the atmosphere for 100 years or more, we're going to have some measure of warming and change no matter what we do, Betsy. What is at stake is, and the reason why we need to urgently, dramatically start to reduce our emissions, is staving off the most harmful and the worst changes. So Steve is absolutely right. People who focus on, you know, we can adapt, or have their heads in the sand, in the oil sands, as it were.
That was our theme song for a long time. And then after Katrina, when I finally started hearing, you know, fellow mothers in Marin County talking about, gee, could this be global warming, I decided maybe we are starting to take our heads out of the sand. But I guess it'll really be the case when I hear them talking about it more than once a year.
Yeah, indeed.
Our last quote is from Ross Gelbspan again, because he is such a vocal, outspoken journalist turned, you know, author turned activist on this issue. Of course, the greater global community is willing to make the transition to cleaner energy and sustainable lifestyles, or more so than we are, it seems. But with the U.S. still not quite on board, but hopefully moving in that direction, Gelbspan says we just simply can't afford to let others do their part while we don't do our part, that we, as a strong superpower, or I think last time we checked, we're still a superpower, what, I don't know, but maybe contributing to global warming and emissions and pollution and all that stuff, but that it's really our job to help transfer sustainable technologies to poor nations.
There is really no resistance in developing countries to make this transition. They would love to do it. The most air-polluted cities in the world are in Bangkok, Thailand, and in China, and in Santiago, Chile, and Mexico City. So developing countries would love to go solar. The real issue is that they can't afford it. What really needs to happen is a mechanism to transfer clean energy to poor countries, and that, I think, is a real human rights issue, and it's an equity issue as well, and it's an issue the Bush administration is using as an excuse for inaction on the part of the United States.
Perhaps if we do nothing else, we can say that, you know, global warming is not just an environmental concern. It's really a moral, as Ross Gelbspan said, a human rights issue.
Oh, very much so. What we saw in the damage of Katrina and Wilma in the Gulf states was that the poorest in those communities were hardest hit. They had less ability to get out of the way. Their homes were more vulnerable, often in the low-lying areas. Think about that on a global scale. We absolutely have a moral responsibility to tackle this problem. We have 6% of the population in the United States. We produce 25% of the global warming pollutants. But you know what, Betsy? It's also the policy that the Bush administration is following on this is just plain dumb economic policy. The companies in Europe and in Japan, increasingly in China, because they are bought into this treaty and these obligations to reduce emissions, they are investing aggressively in much more efficient technologies. And they're able to sell those more efficient technologies not only into their own economies, but back into ours. If you think about, you know, Toyota and Honda were the first ones out with hybrid cars, selling them back into our market here because the domestic auto companies are way behind in building more efficient vehicles.
And as we talk about a lot on the show, because in addition to hosting this program, I'm also the founder of a grassroots campaign called Don't Be Fueled, Mothers for Clean and Safe Vehicles. If you want to find out more about that, go to that website, which is www.don'tbefueled.org, and sign our petition asking Detroit to make more fuel-efficient hybrid cars. And that was a campaign started 4 years ago, so maybe we mothers were ahead of GM and Ford.
Well, you most certainly were, and I think that's right. We do a lot of direct work with the domestic auto companies, and I was in a meeting with the top Ford Motor Company brass a couple years ago where I said, you know, I don't understand why you're not building a hybrid minivan. I said,
the quintessential family car, you know, the minivan.
Well, and I said, look, here's the ad that you do. You get a soccer mom, and I was a soccer coach for years. You're a soccer mom. Get a soccer mom standing with, you know, her kids in front of your new hybrid minivan, and she can talk into the camera. She can say, I didn't want to have to choose between convenience and safety and my children's future. That's why I bought the Ford minivan.
And I can't tell you how many of my friends and fellow moms, parents, and even, you know, single folks who just, you know, their lease has expired, they're in the market for a new car, and there's just so few hybrid choices, and that's one of the problems. But hopefully we have gotten that loud and clear across to Detroit that there is demand for these cars. We just have about 30 seconds left, Kevin. What can people do if they want to find out more about what they can do?
Well, we'd be delighted if your listeners came to our website at www.ucsusa.org. There's a wonderful features and information there. The most important thing people can do is talk to your elected officials and tell them, insist, we need leadership on global warming.
Thank you, Kevin Knobloch with Union of Concerned Scientists, for joining us. We want to thank our sponsors. EcoTalk is brought to you by Pet Ecology Brands, makers of scientific professional eco-friendly ultra-lightweight cat litter. Also our partners, UCS and Earth Justice, joining us as an environmental partner. We need your support as listeners. We have some advertisers. That's great, but it's not quite enough to pay for the price of doing EcoTalk. Go to our website at ecotalk.net to find out how you can get us off the endangered list.